Hello, welcome to the House of Commons. This is a regular podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I'm a political blogger and commentator. And every week we get a guest on from the world of politics and or journalism to discuss the two or three biggest political topics of the week. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Nick Dennis, who is a conservative blogger and local councillor and also a former co-host of this podcast. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for asking me to come back.
No problem. And what have you been up to since you were an actual co-host of this podcast then?
Not a lot, really. I've become a dad, which obviously is not very time consuming at all, as you know.
Indeed.
I've become a local councillor as well, which has also been, very good. That's about it, really. Just getting involved in more local politics, I suppose, than the national stuff that I was doing previously.
Well, congratulations on all of those things.
Thank you.
Okay. Right. So the first thing I want to talk about, so I haven't done one of these for a couple of weeks now. So the vexed question of the debates, the TV debates for the upcoming general election keep rearing its head. It hasn't really been in the news so much this week, but it was in the news a lot the week before. Just to bring us up to date, roughly where we are, Cameron has essentially refused to go along with what the broadcasters want to do and instead has insisted that he will only take part in one debate, and that debate will have to be before the short campaign begins, which effectively means it has to be before the end of March. In fact, perhaps slightly earlier, I think it's by the 28th of March. It needs to be held in order to fit in with that criteria. But the broadcasters seem to be trying to call his bluff and insisting they're still going to have the three debates that they've talked about for a while now. First debate a few weeks before, which is going to have seven people, and then another debate 2 weeks later with seven people. And the final debate, I think it's the week before, 2 weeks before the general election, which is just going to have two people, which should have been David Cameron and Ed Miliband. But if they go ahead with their plan to empty chair the Prime Minister, it might just be Ed Miliband on his own.
That would still be a risk for Ed Miliband.
Yeah, I mean, we can get into all of that. It's all a bit of a mess, though, Nick. I mean, just overall, what do you think about this? A bit of a farce, isn't it?
It's a complete farce. I mean, firstly, my position is that the debate should happen. Television is by far the number one place where people get their information and their news from, and the idea that we don't have debates coming up to a general election between main party leaders, I think is just just doesn't work in modern society. I know there is this sort of the constitutional argument that you're electing your local MP and you should go along to your local hustings, which of course you should go along to your local hustings, but the reality is most people are electing a party and they are electing a prime minister who's going to be presidential. So the prime minister, if you want to go down the constitutional argument, we have a prime minister, not a president. But actually, the prime minister has, the power of a president in many ways. They represent us on the world stage. They pick the cabinet depending on the majority they have in parliament. They can really sort of, they sort of set the tone for legislation that's going to be passed. So I think in reality, we should have decent television debates, and I do like the idea of at least one of them being between the two people who are going to become prime minister. I'm disappointed that they're not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me a little bit like Cameron wants it both ways here. In fact, he wants it both ways in more than one way. So the first way he wants it both ways is that he does sort of run things, I suppose it's inevitable given how politics works these days, but things are run quite presidentially. He'll kind of step in and make announcements and try and steer things and use the bully pulpit of the fact that he is prime minister to make things happen in the way that he wants to in a pretty presidential way. But then when it comes to the debates, it's all about the party and it's all about the campaign and all of his colleagues as well. And it's not just all about him. And also another way in which he's trying to have it both ways is that the Tories for the last couple of years, really, possibly even longer, have been trying to frame the upcoming general election as a question of who do you want, David Cameron or Ed Miliband? And they've been trying to kind of, point out what they perceive to be Ed Miliband's weaknesses, very, very presidential way of campaigning, very kind of personal way. And yet when it comes to the one opportunity for both the two contenders, as you said, the only two contenders who are actually going to be prime minister, to be up against each other for 90 minutes or a couple of hours on live television, he's wriggled out of it, or he's tried to wriggle out of it. So again, trying to have it both ways. This doesn't reflect well on him, does it?
No, not at all. And it's and it's I think it's, as you know, I don't know, as a politician, I would always say that give me any opportunity to speak to people, to speak to the public, you know, I'll do it, because I believe in what I stand for. I believe in what I'm trying to do, and I'm happy to talk to anybody in any place about it. And that's how I generally feel. And I you know, I'm only a local councillor, but that's how I feel. And I think the Conservatives, you know, the Conservative government, the coalition government, which the Conservatives are obviously a major part of, has a good story to tell on many things, and can make a very good argument. So I'm disappointed that I think, you know, over clever politics is being played here with the TV debates. Just get out there, go head to head with Ed Miliband, you know, and I think the Conservatives can beat him. I think Cameron can beat him, and show and basically hammer home the point that you know, the current government is, it has been doing very well, and it should continue. And I, you know, so, but obviously, you know, but the problem is that too many people have been thinking too hard about possible consequences and strategy, and they've ended up creating this muddle, which I think you're right, doesn't reflect well on Cameron in the end, unfortunately.
So, I mean, obviously you're a member of the Conservative Party. So, I mean, do you, I've debated this on Twitter, and I've had various people, sometimes they're Tory members, sometimes they're not, sometimes they just, you know, don't like Labour, I think. But I've had plenty of people come along and try and say, Cameron hasn't been playing games here. It's the fault of the broadcasters, and it's the fault of the other people. And, you know, why couldn't they have just accepted this, that, and the other? And they've tried to say it's not Cameron's fault, and he hasn't been playing games behind the scenes here. I mean, I pay pretty close attention to politics. I have done for 20 years. It's very clear to me that it's the Tories that have been playing the, you know, playing the games behind the scenes here to try and scupper this. Do you agree with that?
Oh, well, I mean, obviously, I'd caveat by the fact that saying that the broadcasters haven't played it very well, and the broadcasters should, you know, I take sympathy with the argument that we've known for a long time when the election's going to be, and we've known for a long time that TV debates were what we wanted, and the broadcasters should have sorted this out 6, 7 months ago. And where I do sympathise very much with the Conservative position is that, if we have should have free debates of different types, and I think that is, you know, reasonable, then it shouldn't all happen within the sort of month, you know, 6 weeks short election period. It should be spread out maybe over 3 months.
But the manifestos
So
aren't published until a few weeks before the
yeah.
election.
Well, indeed, but I don't think I think what happened last time, you know, having free debates within what is a very short cycle, and you're right, takes away all the oxygen from everything else in the campaign. I don't think that's very good. And you know, there isn't a perfect you know, answer to this question. But if you are going to have free debates, I think you know, I think you'd have to have one in the short campaign, whichever way round you do it. So I think the broadcasters haven't been, you know, they haven't really been very good, really. And they should have. I mean, the whole sort of SNP thing is ridiculous, because surely the answer to that question is obviously you have a debate up in Scotland with the leader of the Scottish parties. And, you know, the idea that, you know, the SNP are going to be a very important party in the next party, but they shouldn't be in a national leadership debate, because, you know, 80% of the country is not going to get a chance to vote for the SNP.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I'm
So.
inclined to agree with that. But the reason why the broadcasters ended up dragging the SNP and Plaid Cymru in is because Cameron kicked off and said that with the original proposal, it was going to be four leaders. So it was going to be Cameron, Miliband, Clegg, and Farage. And then there was going to be another debate, which was just going to be like last time, the three leaders of the three main parties, the three parties that have the most representation in Parliament at the moment, so Cameron, Clegg, and Miliband, and then a final two-way debate. And he wasn't happy with that. He insisted that the Greens had to be invited, which I can sort of see why you might make an argument for that. But again, that just seemed like he was throwing up chaff to try and confuse things.
Which is why the broadcasters should have sorted out, you know, what was going to happen months ago in order to sort it out between themselves and stick to it.
Well,
now,
again, I mean, I think they did. My understanding, and again, I mean, this will all come out in the memoirs in years to come. I always find it fascinating to read memoirs and then compare it with what people were saying at the time, because they never, ever match. And you can then discern what the spin was. And I imagine in this situation, we'll find that the broadcasters were trying as hard as they could to try and get things sorted. My understanding is there were meetings that were scheduled, and the Tory representative was supposed to turn up and they didn't turn up, whereas all the other parties did. So that's why I'm saying that I think it's the Tories that have messed around with this process. And I mean, I think the reason why, I think, you know, if we kind of cut to the chase here, is because Cameron thinks, and I think a lot of people around him think, that it was the debates that robbed him of a majority last time, and he doesn't want to make the same mistake again. The problem is, he's on record many, many times before the previous election, and I think also after the election, where he said that he thought the debates were a really good thing. And, you know, it got millions and millions of people watched those debates. Mm. You know, I think that the viewership was far higher than anyone ever thought that it would be.
I think the first one was watched by 20 million, I think.
Yeah.
A massive number in modern TV.
Exactly. It's a lot of people. And I think it engaged people in a way that perhaps hadn't happened in a lot of previous elections, certainly a lot of recent previous elections. And therefore, I personally am very disappointed at the way this has gone. I don't know what the answer is. Maybe we need some kind of independent commission, although, you know, God save us from independent commissions. But at the same time, it's quite clear that you can't just leave it to the broadcasters and the politicians, because there will be games played, really, if we're going to see this, you know, stabilise and mature for future elections. We can't have this palaver every time. I mean, you know, this has been going on for weeks and months. It reflects terribly badly on our politics. If anything, this is going to be turning more people off than, you know, than if just debates had never been on the agenda at all.
Indeed. And ultimately, while, you know, it is important in one aspect, it's not as important as all the news oxygen it's been taking, really. So,
I agree.
I mean, hey, it should. I think the Conservatives aren't very good at this type of thing. I mean, for, you know, a minor example is on BBC Three, they do this programme called Free Speech, which is aimed at sort of politics issues for younger people, which I think is a very good programme. And normally what they have this panel of people, and then, you know, but then they'll sometimes cut to politicians' view, and what you'll normally have is Ed Miliband giving a view, Nick Clegg giving a view, then maybe the Tories will put up someone like Charlotte Leslie or someone, and then for me that sort of shows that the Conservative Party are still very bad actually at understanding how to you know, interact in the mediums where people want to interact. I mean, and you know, the TV debates on their own don't think will make you know, much difference really, and this is why Cameron is able to sort of, you know, stand firm with the game playing, and you know, that this, my example on free speech doesn't make very much difference. But actually, I think overall, the fact that the Tories don't engage with people in the way that people expect to be engaged with actually doesn't help our image as being a party that's potentially in touch. And I think, you know, the Tory party themselves shoot themselves in the foot ultimately by adding up all these little things. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's my view. Lots of people know my view.
I mean, I think in the end, the one thing that the Tories have been very, very good at over the last 100 years, at least, probably longer, has been, you know, capturing the zeitgeist and finding ways to stay in power and keep power, you know, to themselves, even if on occasions like recently they've had to share it with other people. And I agree with you. I think that, you know, they've dropped the ball a few times in this area, but, you know, they'll get someone in at some point in the next few years, like maybe Boris Johnson or, you know, or someone else who's really good with the media, who will get all of that stuff. A little bit like the royal family, and the royal family constantly had to reinvent itself. You know, think about in my lifetime in 1997 when Diana died, you know, and they responded pretty flat-footedly to that situation, but they turned things around pretty quickly. And, you know, now they've kind of adapted and modernized themselves to the new age. And I think the Tories are quite like that. So I'd be very surprised if, you know, in another 5 or 10 years, we didn't see quite a radical change in that respect, and that they will engage much more with, well, BBC Three might not exist by that point, but, you know, whatever its spiritual successors are. You know, I have no doubt that the Tories will still be vying for and very close to power over the coming decades. It's just a case of, you know, they have to go through some pain before they realise the mistakes that they're making in terms of that.
Do you think it'll actually have an effect, though? The fact that the debates won't happen.
Yeah, I think it will. I'm not sure it's enough to make the difference between, you know, the Tories being the largest party or not. But I definitely, I mean, I've picked this up. Most people I know in my normal life aren't interested in politics. I came to politics quite late, as I think we've talked about before. So I am able in these sort of situations to kind of get the measure of people who I know who aren't interested in politics. And this has not gone down well at all. He is seen as, I mean, this whole, chicken meme that's going around. People do think that he's bottled out, and they can't really understand why either, because it just seems unnecessary. Given he's always projecting himself as this strong leader, as Ed Miliband is really weak, it doesn't fit. Something doesn't seem right, and I think it is going to cost. It will be impossible to discern what it's cost, because you can never run the counterfactual of if he'd gone along with the debates exactly as they'd been scheduled. But my gut feeling is it will cost the Tories. Whatever they end up, however well they end up doing or otherwise in the election, I think they'd have done a bit better if they'd have gone along with the with the debates. But that's it's an unprovable, isn't
Fair enough.
it? Okay, let's move on to the next topic. I want to talk about this because it's been in the news this week, and also more recently as well, and housing. So all three main parties, I have to be careful when I say that these days, because really the Lib Dems are on about 5% in the polls. Really, I should be talking about UKIP. Let me rephrase it. The three parties that have the most representation in the current parliament, I think I used that phrase earlier on, didn't
Yes,
I?
you did. It'd take a long time, though. This podcast would take such a long time if we had to say that before every
Yeah.
single.
All right. Okay. From now on, I'll just say three main
Yeah,
parties.
three main parties.
That's true, at least for the next few weeks.
Indeed.
So the three main parties have had policies on housing. So I believe that Labour are talking about building several hundred thousand homes. I think the Tories have talked about building 200,000. The Lib Dems, they probably have similar targets for building, but they also have this rent to buy thing that they've launched this week, which my understanding seems a bit contrived to me, to be honest. But they're saying that if you live in the same place for 30 years and you paid rent for 30 years, then you end up owning the house, which really see how that's very much different from a mortgage, frankly. But I don't know, I guess the terms are going to be different, and if you decided to leave after 5 years, you wouldn't have any obligations. So I guess there must be ways in which they're making this more palatable, but it all seems a bit strange. And really, I
It
mean,
sounds like they're applying a Margaret Thatcher's right to buy, but to private land, to apply to private landlords,
yeah,
not to council houses.
don't really
It's
understand
interesting.
the full details of how that's supposed to work. But really, in my experience, politicians around election time throw promises about housing around like confetti. I think what the Lib Dems are trying to do is they're trying to address this new demographic that's been identified, Generation Rent. All these people who are renting houses who can't ever see a way that they would ever own their own house. I think they're trying to address that, which is a laudable aim, I think. But I think there are some very embedded structural issues to do with housing in this country that a kind of a superficial policy announcement isn't really going to address. I mean, what do you think about this stuff? And actually, just in terms of declaring interest, I own my own house. I have a mortgage on it, or I own it outright, but I own my own house. Do you, Nick, or do you rent?
I do. I own my own house as well.
Okay,
So,
so
but
we're so we're both winners. We don't really understand this these whinging renters, do we?
oh well. I mean, I used to be a whinging renter till about 4 years ago. So,
Hmm.
I think I can just about remember back till then. But yeah, no. I mean, first of all, it's one of those issues where everyone knows it's an issue, and I managed to just scrape onto the housing ladder, and I'm very grateful for it. But already the house that I own, I wouldn't be able to afford. Even I was only just able to afford it when me and my wife got it, and now we've lived in a house for years. I wouldn't be able to buy it, and that's how, that just feels mental to me,
So,
completely
has your
mental.
house earned more money than you in that time then?
Quite possibly. I haven't worked out, but I know.
Because I was in that situation. We put our house on the market where we used to live in Berkshire in 2013, and then we were offered a certain amount of money for it, but then for various reasons we took it off. And then we put it back on the following year, and the amount of money we sold the house for eventually, when you looked at what we'd been offered the year before, so effectively what it was worth and what it was worth a year later, and then you worked out the difference, and then I looked at my salary, my house had earned more than me during that time, which is ridiculous because the house just sat there and didn't do anything.
Indeed, indeed. Oh well, indeed. So, and it's a crazy situation, and it's one of those issues that people talk about and they worry about, and they worry for their kids and their grandkids. But actually, whenever they do these surveys about what are the most important election issues, it's way down, like a number 10, number 11, and people don't tend to actually really vote on it, you see. So this is why it's a problem politically, I think. Everyone knows it's a problem and it's building up to be a problem, you know, like pensions, for example, is another similar one. But because it isn't up there with immigration, NHS, all those sort of things, politicians don't really, you know, give it enough attention, unfortunately.
And isn't it also a function of the fact, I mean, we see this with the kind of the demographic difference in voting patterns between very young people and very old people. Old people are much more likely to vote. Yeah. So you end up with things like the triple lock on the pensions, the protected winter fuel allowance, protected TV licenses, free bus passes, etc. And then the younger generation see the, you know, the benefits being frozen or cut and limited to certain amounts. And you see things like child benefit frozen and also limited to, you know, so working age benefits are kind of hammered down and down and down. And it always seems to me that that's a function of the fact young people don't vote enough and older people vote more than they do, and therefore they get the goodies. And don't we see a similar effect here in that the people who are more likely to vote are the people who own property. The people who rent for various reasons are less likely to vote, not least because if you're renting, you're usually on a pretty short notice period and you can be evicted quite quickly. And if you're evicted and you have to move to a different area, you might not have time to get on the electoral register before you vote. So there are practical considerations. And if you move in house all the time, it's a pain in the arse to have to keep remembering all the stuff you have to keep track of. I mean, although I rather flippantly at the start of this said that, you know, I'm one of the winners. Well, I might be now, but I rented for over 10 years and I remember how incredibly frustrating it was, you know, from the days when I was a student right through until... you know, a good 10 years later when I was still renting and sharing houses and eventually I was renting places on my own, just how difficult it is. You've got to keep track of everything. You've got to, all the companies you have relationships with, you've got to write off to them and change your address. Every time you fill in a form, they ask you for your current address and then if you've lived anywhere else in the last 3 years. And if you do, you've got to fill that in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's an absolute pain. And I think the lack of security of tenure for people who rent privately in this country is a disgrace, really. And not that I think there's any easy answer. I don't think there is, but I think it is terrible. And yeah, just to come back to my original point, you know, people who rent are just less likely to vote. So it's one of these kind of, you know, ongoing downward spirals that it's very difficult to get parties to respond to that, because ultimately, you know, people respond to incentives, and politicians have responded to the incentive of the people who are more likely to vote.
Yep. So, kids, if you're listening, vote. It does make a difference.
Yeah, I know. I keep saying that. I really feel like I should start going around schools and just telling people to vote. And it doesn't matter who you vote for.
You'll need permission from the school first, otherwise you might get
arrested. What if I'm just like standing outside the school gate ranting about voting with a not even a megaphone, just my voice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, essentially, in some ways, it's very simple. You know, more houses, more decent houses need to be built in places where people want to live. And, you know, there's a mixture of way of doing these things, and I actually favour doing the mixture. So one of the big reasons why house building has declined over the last 10, 15 years is because essentially the state has stopped building houses. Now, I know that there are many people, you know, in my party who have an allergic reaction to the state doing anything. But unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, I think the state can do many good things. You know, the state has to get back into building houses. Also, in terms of, you know, making it easier to buy plots for people to buy plots of land and to build their own houses, the state, you know, should, you know, laws should be made to do that as well. I'm going to say something controversial now, but I'm not a fan of the green belt. I think the green belt is basically an artificial device. I mean, who the hell decided that London should only be a certain size and wasn't allowed to grow? I mean, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, now, Simon Jenkins wrote a very interesting piece on this a couple of weeks ago, and I think I'd heard him on the Spectator podcast. Other good podcasts are available, including this one. And yeah, he was making that same point. He was making the point that, you know, the green belt isn't what people think it is. People have this idea that it's like, you know, flowing fields and hills of greenery, and it's absolutely beautiful, and it's a tantamount to a, you know, site of scientific special interest. But actually, it isn't like that at all. It's just land that, for all kinds of complicated historical reasons, has been designated green belt.
And it's almost like somebody's built drawn a circle around London, but obviously London needs to get bigger. You know, this is why house prices in London keep on going up higher than anywhere else. And, you know, I live in one of the Metroland properties, basically, when the Metro line was extended in the 1930s out to sort of the Pinner area. You know, obviously it was all fields out here, and then when the Metro line came out here, they started building all these houses. So I live in a 1930s house which, you know, would have been, you know, was just on the outskirts of London. So, you know, it's a bit hypocritical for me to sit here in this house saying, actually, no, they can't build 10 miles up the road because it's the green belt necessarily. Now, I'm not saying, of course, by saying that, I'm not saying that everywhere should be built around. And of course, there are lots of areas of green land that should be protected. But being a local council, one of the things I do notice as well is because we have the green belt, this ring around London that doesn't allow you to build anywhere, there's a hell of a lot of pressure on green land within London. So actually, in a funny way, the green belt, I think, destroys green areas within London because, you know, developers obviously, for a start, land developing in London is extremely profitable. And so developers want to develop on any possible green land possible. But also because they can't build anywhere else, they're always trying to steal space, essentially, within the London walls. So that doesn't help London. So, you know, I think the green belt policy is completely counterproductive and artificial, and I would get rid of it.
What about the problem of NIMBYism as well, though, because that surely plays an important part in this question. And you have, on the one hand, you know, people living in these villages, and again, declare my interest, I live in a village, at least I do now. In fact, it's more like a hamlet. And, you know, you get these people living in these sort of areas. I hopefully won't piss too many of my neighbours off by saying what I'm about to say. But you do get these groups that spring up and that object to development. And so on the one hand, you have people complaining that their children can't buy houses in the towns or villages that they grew up in. But at the same time, any new development, you know, there's a real battle to get it through. And I've got a friend who lives in a beautiful village in Devon. And two or three years ago, there was a plan to build, I don't know how many houses it was. I think it was about 50 houses or 60 houses. And I think the village he lives in has about 120 houses, something like that. So it was going to, you know, make the village half again as big. And there was a protest group that sprang up and it was defeated eventually by weight of local protest. And I know that that is not an isolated incident. You know, that sort of thing happens all over the place. So if we're going to get the sort of volume of houses, because my understanding is just to stand still, we'd need to build 200,000 houses a year, or it might even be 250,000 houses a year. And actually, really, we need to build more than that because of the kind of demographic time bomb that's coming down the track anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot more people are living on their own now as well. I think it's something like 23%. If the patterns of the way people live now were the same as they were 40 years ago. So, you know, more people living, you know, in shared houses and, you know, sharing with their families and all the rest of it, then you'd need 23% less, or fewer rather, houses than we have now. Mm. So you've got all of these things coming in. But I mean, what do you do about NIMBYism? Because at the end of the day, you know, all the parties will talk about devolving decisions down to local areas. But if you live in a beautiful village, you don't want houses being built in the same way as you don't want wind farms being built near where you. It always boils down to this question, doesn't it? The battle between the centre and the local.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, there's nothing wrong with NIMBYism. I mean, NIMBYism is people who care about their local area.
Yeah, you see, you've got to say that because you're a local councillor, Nick.
You've got to let me finish, though. But so, I've got to say that. And also, I have experience of that as well. So there is no problem with you know, the NIMBYism, idea. I mean, but rather than devolving decision-making, I think you should devolve responsibility, really. So, for example, I'm a councillor in an area called East Coney's Ryslip, and we're part of Hillingdon, which is on the edge of London, one of the boroughs on the edge of London. And you know, I think I would favour a system such as different boroughs and you know, county councils basically being given targets centrally, but then having the freedom in order of, you know, in terms of how they meet their targets. So it's essentially basically saying to people, you know, we need to build this many houses because otherwise there's this massive issue that's coming down the road that none of us really wants. Now, how best shall we do this in your local area? And so then you've got the clash between, and obviously if those targets aren't met within a certain time frame, then central planners will come in and do it for you, would be the sort of stick element of it. And because when I speak to people, even people who are, you know, might be classed as NIMBYs, they completely recognise the bigger picture problem that, you know, their grandkids won't be able to, can't buy a house and still, you know, still living with their, you know, their parents at the time, and how that's really troubling. So there is this, people do know it's an issue. So I believe you devolve responsibility, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I, I guess sometimes the suggested response to NIMBYism is just to dictate from the centre, but that in itself is fraught with all kinds of problems, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And I that's what I would do. I mean, I would give I would create a framework where local authorities, through consultation, all this sort of stuff, would have greater ability to build how they wanted, where they wanted. But obviously had to be certain standards. But but there would have to be an understanding that you'd have to do something. I mean, interestingly, I went to Harlow the other day, and I spoke to a guy who essentially was one of the first people to move to Harlow after the new town was built, and he worked in the the housing office in terms of giving rents and allocating houses. And it was really interesting to listen to his story about Harlow and how when it was first proposed, there were lots of obviously local protests, but when it started being built, then many of the locals actually thought, well, it's actually quite good because it's regenerated the area in terms of, more shops coming in and more young people staying around. So a lot of these areas where people, are wary of change, actually, building new houses or building new centres actually improves some of the things, some of the isolation problems that they are also fearing at the same time. So, people's minds do change after things, do get built. So, anyway,
okay.
It was a really interesting chat with him, actually, seeing how obviously, and one thing I did learn is building a new town is a very, very difficult and complex business. But I would devolve responsibility. I would give boroughs and county councils targets and say, give them a free hand in terms of, and also local consultation stuff about how they actually meet those targets.
Just before we move on from this topic, do you believe any of the parties, do you believe that whatever they've promised will actually happen? Because I have to say I'm highly sceptical.
do I believe any of the parties? I have to say I haven't really looked at this area too deeply of what the manifesto, I suppose when the manifestos will get published.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a bit vague and woolly at the moment, we're talking hundreds of thousands of houses. Yeah,
I won't answer your question directly, but I believe within the next 10 years, the government is going to have to seriously deal with this matter. It can't stop. It can't keep on putting it down the road. So I think it's really, I think it's going to be, I think it's really crucial that the next government who comes in does deal with it.
Yeah. So you didn't quite not accept the premise of my question, but you nearly did.
No. I obviously I wouldn't want to say anybody's not going to keep their promise in politics.
I know. Just imagine if that was to happen. Okay.
Indeed. But I think, you can't avoid it. It's going to be, it has to be dealt with. You have to do something about it.
Yeah. Well, actually, I've got a segue here because the fact that politicians will sometimes make promises that it's difficult for them to keep is probably one of the contributing factors to the final thing that we're going to talk about today, which is a topic that you nominated, actually, Nick, and that you wrote a piece for in the last few days, I believe. You described it yourself when you contacted me about it as the perniciousness of political jargon, which is a pleasingly alliterative phrase. Do you want to explain what your beef is about this? Because I think from what I've read and from what I've seen you say about this, that actually my beef is quite similar to yours. But if you give me your take on it first.
Yeah, definitely. On Thursday, I went to the launch of this initiative by Tim Montgomery called The Good Right, which essentially is creating a broader base conservatism, which will, get at least 40% of the population supporting, including people from, lower middle classes who might not feel that the Tories care about them. Anyway, so Michael Gove gave a 30-minute speech launching the project, and it was a fantastic speech. And I would say to anybody, read it, watch it if you're interested in politics. It was really, it was well written and it was well delivered. And while I was watching Michael Gove deliver the speech, I thought, you're really enjoying this and you really enjoyed writing this. And I thought, why is this? And then it struck me. Because there was no political jargon. He did not once mention a long-term economic plan. He did not once, talk about, all those, all the catchphrases, hard work. He didn't mention hardworking families or whatever. He just said what he believed in language that he would normally use. And I thought, well, but that's how it should be. I mean, too many politicians spend too much time trying to be too clever, when what they should do is really just talk to people in the same way they talk to their friends.
Yeah. I mean, I totally, go on, Karen.
Just to finish quickly on this bit, but the two most successful political communicators at the moment are Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson. And all they do is they talk to people in the same way they talk to their friends. So one example quickly is Boris Johnson was asked the other day, do you know which two London football teams are competing in the League Cup final? And he said, no, I don't really like football. I haven't got much time to watch it. That's brilliant because, you know, everyone who listens to that go, yeah, that's fair enough. You know, he doesn't have to like football. But, you know, politics gets wrapped into such a crazy idea about what people should and shouldn't say that you can imagine somebody, you know, knowing but not really caring, or somebody trying to bluster through that answer.
So, yeah, I mean, there's so many strands I could go off on here. Just quickly, another Boris Johnson story that I read a few weeks ago was he was at some event, I think it was in the US, and he was asked a hypothetical situation, if there was a lifeboat and there was only room for two people, who would he choose out of David Cameron and George Osborne to save along with himself? And he said he would give up his space in the lifeboat and allow both David Cameron and George Osborne to take the life raft, and he would swim heroically to shore in order to raise the alarm. That is one of the best answers to a hypothetical political question I've ever heard. He is an amazingly good communicator. And I think you're right. I think it is in his case. And I mean, I don't particularly like Nigel Farage, and maybe it's because I can sort of see through his bluster. But I can understand that people do think he's just a kind of geezer you'd have a pint down a pub with. I do understand that attraction that he has.
It's because he wouldn't ask you for a One Nation pint.
Well,
he wouldn't talk to you about a long-term economic plan.
Or, you know, classical neo-endogenous growth theory or whatever it was.
Nigel Farage, basically, he just talks to people like they talk to other people. It's not that difficult, is it?
Well, this is the crux of the question, though, isn't it? Because I agree with you. I think politicians should be more straight with people and shouldn't speak in jargon and should try and be more human. But then the question arises, why don't they? Why aren't they? Why do they feel they can't? Why have we ended up here?
Well, my theory is based on it's essentially over cleverness. And it's basically getting too many potentially advisors in. I mean, politicians want to win elections, okay? And they want to discover the secret that will allow them to win elections. And so what they do is they employ people who, you know, can help them do that. So, and obviously communication is extremely important in politics, getting a message across. Also, you know, advisors do make a big difference to politicians and can help politicians do even better than they would do normally. But unfortunately, what this has led to, I think, is advisors and consultants essentially coming up with over clever strategies to promote themselves as much as to give somebody a winning answer. So, for example, is it David Messina coming over from the Obama team in the States to Conservatives? He told Conservative MPs that the electorate will only think about the general election set for 7 seconds between now and polling day.
I think it was 7 seconds per day, to be fair. Not in total.
Sorry, 7 seconds per day. Well, you know, that's bollocks.
Yeah,
sorry
I
if
agree.
Anybody does. You know, it's a phrase that makes him sound clever and allows him to create this, okay, you need to repeat this one catchphrase all the time. It doesn't matter if you sound like a weirdo, because actually all they'll listen to is the 1 7 seconds. You know, and it just doesn't work like that. So what? And then when politicians are advised by people like that, you get the situation like when I saw an interview with George Osborne, and Jon Snow was interviewing George Osborne, and obviously George Osborne was in his high vis jacket and his hard hat as normal. Every single answer to Jon Snow's question had the term long term economic planning, and it just felt so unnatural. I'm just listening to that, I'm thinking, what? It's no wonder people switch off from you if you just talk in a way that's completely foreign and unnatural to them.
Yeah, but that's right. I mean, and that's the crux of the problem, isn't it? Because it's to do with the messaging. It's to do with the kind of soundbite culture. It's to do with, you said about long-term economic plan, and that phrase is already driving me nuts. I mean, I spend far too much of my time watching and reading about politics anyway. But it's that sort of stuff that drives me nuts, in the same way as Labour going on and on and on about the cost of living crisis. You know, every single question that they get asked gets twisted into something about the cost of living crisis, in the same way as every question that any on-message Tory MP gets asked gets twisted into an answer about the long-term economic plan. And they think they're being clever, They also think they're being clever when they, you know, and it's actually quite transparent when they do it as well, when they'll be asked a question and the response is, if you're asking me blah, then the answer is blah. It's like, no, that's not what you were asked though. And they think that's very clever. And also, you know, using formulations of words like, I'm very glad that you asked me that question, and I'll tell you why. It's like, you know, they've become political cliches now, but there are similar ways of responding to questions and ways of formulating answers that fit into the same category. You know, imagine if you went out for a pint with your mate and you said, oh, how's your new job going? And he turned around to you and said, I'm very glad that you asked me that question, and I'll tell you why. Or you say, how's your new job going? You say, if you're asking me what my new fridge is like, then I'll tell you what the answer is, and I'm very glad that you've asked me about my fridge, and I'll tell you why. It's like people in real life do not speak like that. They
No.
now I'll sort of try and partially answer the question I posed earlier on, because I agree it's going to be down a little bit to advisors and spin doctors, like you've said, but I think it's worse than that. I think it's that they're trying not to offend anyone. They're trying
Yeah.
not to give the wrong, in quotes, answer to the question. They're trying not to make a gaffe in some way, and therefore they'll try and give the most bland and inoffensive answer to a question possible. And I'll give you a classic example. I've used this on many occasions before. There was a problem on the railways many years ago when John Prescott was Transport Secretary. He was actually Deputy Prime Minister, but I think Transport was under his auspices. It's not a place you want to be under John Prescott's auspices, is it? And he was asked a question about it after there'd been some horrendous crash, and I think 30 people had died, and it was one of these signals past at danger things, and you know, with better technology, it could have been avoided. And his response was that money was no object, money is no question. And I remember around that time, I did some research, and I think I found that a life on the railway is priced at between about 2 and 3 million pounds. You know, when they're looking at a cost benefit analysis of
Yeah.
a new measure, a new safety measure, that's roughly how they price a life. And that's fair enough. You've got to do that sort of thing.
It sounds sick, but you actually have to have a framework to operate
Exactly.
within.
But imagine the situation when you've got an MP or a minister, and they're asked the question, Minister, how much is a human life worth? How does the minister or the MP answer that question? It's basically an impossible question to answer, because if they answer with the truth, there will be headlines in the tabloid papers that will say, Minister in major gaffe has said that human life is only worth X, whatever they say. They probably have to resign. So, and that's quite an extreme example, but that's an example of how really politicians are forced to not be able to answer the questions, and therefore they'll come up with, and it almost becomes second nature. I remember Michael Howard being interviewed many years later after the infamous 18 times he was asked the question, "Did you threaten to overrule him?"
Yeah.
by Paxman on Newsnight, and he said the answer to the question was actually no. I didn't threaten to overrule him. And then the interviewer said, well, why didn't you just say that? And he said, I don't know, really. I just kind of got myself into a you know, where I was at the time, I just felt like I had to use the formulation of words that I'd used. And I think he thought after the fifth or sixth or eighth time Paxman had asked him, he'd move on, but he didn't. And it became excruciatingly embarrassing. But they get into these patterns of speaking, and it becomes second nature. And I think Ed Miliband is a classic example of that. He's been in or around politics ever since he was a child. I don't think he's capable of answering questions like a human being.
No, indeed. I think rather than his technique in terms of eating bacon sandwiches, I think what has really sort of destroyed Ed Miliband's credibility is the fact that he talks in jargon all the time and uses. You know, I remember when quite recently Labour won a by-election. I can't remember which one, and I read the press release. And every single sentence had One Nation. It was like this was a One Nation by-election, which is a One Nation victory. And I read it, and I just thought, who the hell is writing this stuff? You know what? You know what's in your soul if you think that this is, you know, if you think this is an appropriate way to communicate with people? It's just you're obviously, you know, you're basically alienating people because people can basically if you're so obviously using your rhetorical device rather than speaking normally to communicate your ideas, people are going to think, why does he have to use that clever rhetorical device? Why can't he just speak normally?
Yeah.
Oh, he's a bit dodgy and he's a bit different.
I think the answer is, if you can spot the rhetorical device, you shouldn't be using the rhetorical device. It should be almost hidden from view. You know, I think great orators of the past, if you think about Churchill, he was using devices,
Course, of
but
course.
there was such good structure behind it, and you know, there were such good speeches that you don't even really notice the structure because the content was so good.
Yeah, no, indeed. And it wasn't repeating the same word again and again. And, yeah, and one of the other problems as well is that these words, and they're one nation, long-term economic plan, they're formulated in these rooms and then focus group tested and all this sort of stuff. So by the time this one word or one little phrase comes out, the people who are promoting it then, they know it's gone through all this process and they understand it. So for them, it has loads of meaning. But for average people, for normal people, it has no meaning at all. So repeating it actually doesn't make any difference. Because no one really knows what the long-term economic plan is.
Do you think,
nobody certainly knows what one nation really means.
No, I don't even think the people who were using the phrase one nation. The reason they picked one nation is because they were trying to steal the Tories' clothes from about 25 years earlier. You know, one nation Toryism, it must have seemed terribly politically audacious to steal the exact phrase that the opposition to them used to use a few decades ago. Whereas, you know, geeks like us will know that, but 99.8% of the population won't know that. So it kind of has no resonance or meaning beyond the Westminster bubble anyway. What I was going to ask is, do you think that this will change? I mean, obviously, we've now got what we keep hearing are much more engaged MPs, and MPs that came in say, 2010, are much closer to the constituencies, seem to be much more responsive to what their constituents want than what the party machines want, and seem to be a lot better at things like media with social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. Do you think in another political generation or two, we will see the back of this kind of robotic automaton-like speaking by politicians, and it will just get better by dint of necessity?
Yes, it's the honest answer. As you say, it's already happening actually, because the younger generation who understand, you know, how people communicate with each other, know that it doesn't work and it's all rubbish. Like, you know, obviously every single Tory MP sending the same tweet at the same time, you know, it's so transparent for people on Twitter that actually that's not their personal opinions or their personal views, and so people discard it, for example. Also, I to be honest, I think what we have now is the end point, is the end of Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair, what was very successful, you know, or maybe even started Bill Clinton in the States. And it's basically been, you know, this is the end of the road for that point. It's hitting the wall. And, you know, the next generation of, you know, leaders, if it's next generation Tory leader, will be somebody younger, or be Boris Johnson, who, you know, who doesn't subscribe to this way of doing things, and actually is popular because he doesn't do things in this way. So, but then again, I am an optimist. So,
well, it's not often that we cover a topic on this podcast and we actually end on a positive note. So it's quite nice. All I would say, you just referred to Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. Yes, they did use all kinds of these formulations. And yes, I suppose if you really, really analyze their speeches and their patterns, it's fairly obvious what they were doing. But they were both excellent practitioners of the art. And so, again, a little bit like what I said about Churchill earlier, you didn't really notice it. You know, Tony Blair made some of the best political speeches I've ever seen. I'm thinking particularly of the speech he made when his final speech as Labour leader in 2006. It's certainly the best speech I've ever seen live. Not that I wasn't there, but I watched it live on television. It was incredible. And, you know, and I know I've seen some of Clinton's speeches as well. And I know just from, you know, kind of accounts and stuff that he was the sort of person who, you know, made you feel like you're the only person in the room when he was speaking to you and so forth. I don't think his wife has that ability, by the way, so it'd be interesting what happens over the next year or two. But I think what's happened is that their successors have just been nowhere near as good. Well, actually, in the case of Obama, he probably is as good as Clinton was, to be fair. I'm thinking in this country, I think, you know, the successors to Blair, Brown and Cameron and now Miliband, they're just not as good. They're nowhere near as good as him, actually. So he was able to get away with it for so long because he was such a, you know, such a good speech maker and such a charismatic politician. And, you know, I think we're partly burdened with a particularly dud generation of politicians in terms of charisma, except, you know, as you pointed out, Johnson. Although personally, for my own reasons, I hope Boris Johnson never gets anywhere near the levers of power. So maybe we can still end on a negative note.
Well, you know, I'll be positive and you can be negative, Mark.
All right, fair enough. That probably reflects our characters anyway. So, all right, it's been great to have you back, Nick.
Well, thanks for having me back.
No problem. And good luck with all your campaigning over the next few weeks.
Thank you.
All right, and I'm sure I'll speak to you again soon. And I'd just like to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly host the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.